Thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this conference. The question actually is related to the fact that nowadays there is a lot more interaction, interconnection between bioethics and human rights than in the past. And the question that we can ask is, how can we explain this interconnection? And what kind of interconnection exactly are we talking about? So what I will do in my presentation is to try to show you the background of this growing interconnection, which is a change in the bioethical discourse. A change where nowadays we talk more and more about global bioethics that is no longer limited to only one country, but has an impact in most of the other countries in the world. And especially in my previous job in UNESCO, this connection with human rights was very explicitly made just because of the global dimension of the bioethical discourse. It resulted in a universal declaration of bioethical principles. And in that declaration, there is an explicit linkage with human rights. So we have to ask the question, what kind of linkage is made in this global level between the two discourses? And finally, I will argue that the interconnection with human rights also is changing the discourse of bioethics itself, in a sense that it makes it much more action-driven. And one of the examples is organization Bioethics Beyond Borders. Now, bioethics, as you know, or the ethical discourse in relation to medicine and healthcare, has changed over the last few decades. For a very long time, it was medical ethics emphasizing the virtues of the healthcare professional, the duties of the healthcare professionals, and sometimes it resulted, like in the US, with the establishment of codes of conduct by the medical association. But it was for most of its time a professional ethics run by physicians. That's changed significantly at the end of the 60s and the early 70s, where the ethical discourse took a much broader scope, reflected in a different terminology. In the US, bioethics, in most European countries, we prefer to speak for a long time about healthcare ethics. But the essential thing was that this discourse was open for many other actors and stakeholders. But it was still focused on medical issues. Abortion, already mentioned, euthanasia, genetics, medical technologies. Another change took place not too long ago. Some people say it was around the turn of the century, essentially after the collapse of the communist system, that bioethics really became a global discourse, with involving more and more stakeholders, but more essentially also having a broader range of issues that are on the agenda of the discourse itself. And this change in both cases, in the 70s and in 2000, actually was initiated by this person, Van Rensselaer Potter, who published a book and was the first to use the term bioethics in publications in a journal publication in 1970. His book, 71, Bioethics, A Bridge to the Future. Potter was a cancer scientist, but he learned from his own research in cancer that a focus on biology and medical issues is not enough to get a breakthrough in cancer. You have to look at the culture, lifestyle, environmental conditions in order to know why cancers are developing and how they can be addressed. And we can only do that, according to Potter, if we have a broader scope. So we need a new discipline, that was his argument, where we combine the knowledge that we have in the sciences and in the humanities, bioethics, and this science should focus on long-term problems. The science should focus on the question of human survival, not individual survival, but human survival. Because in his view, the most important problems, and that was the 70s, and you can argue maybe still the same problems are important today, is the most important problems are he called, he all started them with a P, population. we are, human beings are multiplying much faster than the earth can, the earth resources can sustain. Peace is another problem. Maybe not peace, but the lack of peace, war and violence, creating more problems in human history than diseases. Pollution, and that was at a time when there were the first indications of environmental pollution. The Torrey Canyon just was the first example at that time of oil spill. Rachel Carson wrote the first book on the effect of pesticides on the environment. So Potter was actually arguing that we should care in this concept of bioethics with the environment. Poverty, major problem still today. Politics. Politics is a problem according to Potter because politicians always are concerned about the next election. They never think in long-term perspective and progress. The idea, especially important in the US, that there will always be progress. We will always progress positively. We will never deteriorate. So these are, in his view, the basic problems that humankind is facing. And we need to combine our knowledge in order to address these problems, maybe not for ourselves, but for our children and grandchildren. And that is the mission, so to speak, of bioethics in Potter's view. And in fact, if you read his work, and Potter only published two books, this book in 1971, another book in 1988 on global bioethics. And in his work, he actually tries to argue that we have to make several bridges. We have to make a bridge between now and the future. We have to make a bridge between science and values. The separation that we usually make between two different cultures, science and values, ethics and art sciences, is not helping us to overcome our problems, because these problems, the basic problems that we identify, are interdisciplinary problems. They're not problems for a particular scientific discipline. They request that we bring together all the different types of knowledge that we have. We also need to bridge the gap between nature and culture. We know a lot about natural evolution. We don't know a lot about cultural evolution. So we need to use our knowledge of biology, biological processes and evolution also, to study how human cultures are evolving. And we need to bridge finally the gap between man, human beings and nature, because that is causing a deterioration, a degradation of our environment that in the long run will endanger, jeopardize our own existence. So in his view, in his work, human beings are always connected with each other. And that's, I think, well, that was the 70s, you could say, well, nowadays that is maybe the major characteristic of our culture, that we have through all the new media, we are connected and connecting all the time. Connectivity is maybe one of the major characteristics of today. But human beings are, in his view, also bridge building. They are, in the old Roman vocabulary, we say, this is homo pontifex. The human being is always reaching out to other human beings, he is not isolated. And that is important if you look at the development of the ethical discourse, as I will show in a minute. Also, in his work, it's very important that he, of course, is reflecting, but he also wants to have action. It should be, in fact, in ethics, he should have more activism than reflection. We cannot do without reflection, but we cannot simply only focus on reflection. And that is also an idea that he took from William James in American Pragmatism philosophy, that concepts are like bridges. They do not only represent reality, but they lead to something. They bring us from one experience to another experience. So concepts are active agents, so to speak. They are like bridges. So in Potter's idea, we need a new, broader, interdisciplinary field. And this field is starting to emerge. You would say, well, maybe the last 10 years it's clear that this broader concept is emerging. Because there is a new range of problems. I will give you some examples. Due to globalization, really, in economical, political globalization is accelerating during the last decade. But there is also a differentiated evolution. We have the same challenges now everywhere. Medical science is increasingly international. it poses the same challenges, but they're very different responses according to different cultures and different social settings. The infrastructure in many other countries where we have these same problems are also unequally developed. Some countries have experts, committees, legislation. Most countries, and that was clear in my work in UNESCO, they don't have a lot of experts, they don't have legislation, they don't have aid committees. They are lacking the infrastructure that you need to have an adequate biomedical discourse. At the same time, and due to this globalization and urgency to provide all countries with the same biomedical infrastructure, you see that there is a closer linkage growing between bioethics and human rights. And that is especially important in the adoption of, especially in the context of UNESCO, universal frameworks that try to identify principles that can be endorsed by all countries, and then the question is how we can apply them in different contexts. This is a list of some of the new problems that we are facing nowadays in bioethics. They go far beyond the usual problems that we have in medical ethics and in bioethics as such. There are questions regarding international technologies. Technologies are developed in many countries, but most countries have no infrastructure, no know-how to deal with these technologies. For example, nanotechnology developed in a limited number of countries, but all countries are confronted with the impacts of nanotechnologies, and there hardly is any ethical assessment. Not an ethical assessment of what it means for individuals, but also definitely not an ethical assessment of what it means for societies and cultures. Then there also is increasing awareness of gaps that we have and deficiencies in the international system. Very famous, the 90-10 divide identified by WHO. 90% of all resources in the world in healthcare are spent for 10% of the world population, diseases that are relevant for 10% of the world population. So most of the efforts are focused on diseases, conditions that are relevant for a fairly limited number of people. There is now more focus on what are basic healthcare needs, even in developed countries, where the awareness is growing that we cannot allow to continue offering everything that is medically possible. So we have to decide what are more basic services that we need to provide. There are also new problems. Pandemics, for example, they become more. They have created more awareness over the past 10 years that what happens in one country has serious impact on other countries. So you cannot simply leave it to individual countries, but you have to develop an international global response. Also the issue of organ trade. We are now more aware, and WHO has collected data, that 10% of all kidneys is from organ trade. So it means 8,000 kidneys are sold by people in poor countries, and they are transplanted to people in richer countries. So this is not an accident or an incident. This is a worldwide trade that is going on. The same for the brain drain. You see the majority of doctors in countries like Ghana and Malawi are working in other countries. So if people are educated in Ghana and they leave the country, well, the country has invested in their education and they go to work in England or the US. So nothing in return. You have recruitment practices, recruitment agencies from Western countries trying to recruit doctors and nurses in developing countries. So this is interconnected. It's not only our problem that we are solving, but solving our problem means that we create an even bigger problem in other countries. The same for biopiracy, that now we are more aware that representatives of pharmaceutical companies, they send scouts to Brazil or to Sumatra to collect rare species, where they can develop new medication that is patented, and then when they want to use the substance themselves in Brazil or Sumatra, it turns out it's patented in a Western country. So these are also interconnected problems. 50% of all the medication in the world is consumed in the US. So I always joke to my students that in the US they must be very ill if they are using this kind of medication, but 50% of the same medication is tested in developing countries. So we need to make sure that the tests that are run in developing countries are following the same guidelines as we have developed in Western countries. There are also now more awareness of possible misuse and abuse, essentially related to the issue of dual use. If you have a new vaccine, it can be used for beneficial purposes, it can be used to harm people. So the issue of biosecurity, bioterrorism is important here. We also have noticed that the science ethics, as it is usual and assumed to be existing, is seriously endangered also, because we have growing evidence of falsification among scientists, fabrication of data, ghostwriting, publications where the author is not the author. Also, these are not incidents, but it's a quite generalized practice in some areas of the world. You say, well, 10% of all the publications is ghostwritten in medical journals. So this is also shocking, assuming that we have this good developed science ethics, that so many cases come to light almost all the time over the past 10 years in science. So you see, conflict of interest is one of the hot issues nowadays in the ethical debate. Ethics and humanitarian assistance is also a growing new issue. The same with disasters, for example, and ethics. So these are all new issues that have come on the agenda of the bioethical debate. One issue, if you work in developing countries, is that there is widespread corruption, also in the healthcare system. It's not an issue in bioethics until recently. So there is more attention now that this is a basic issue. We can build ethics committees. But if the members of various committees and even on protocols are bribed by the pharmaceutical companies, then what is the purpose of the ethics committee? So there are all these questions that come up if you look at a more international level, global scale. You see, there are many more issues than only concern us here in Western countries. And this has created the idea that now we are in a new stage of bioethics, called global bioethics. That has essentially two faces, because you have the globalization on the one hand, the same problems, the same techniques, the same medication is going to all the countries in the world, available potentially for everybody. But at the same time, you have localization. The global issues always need to be applied in a very specific context. And here you see also that there is development in the area of bioethics, that on the one hand, there is a closer association with international law at the level of globalization. On the more specific level of localization, there is a growing interaction with social sciences and anthropology to know more about the local conditions and the cultures in which global ideas will be applied. And this is maybe the major challenge. How can we apply commonly shared values that are identified in several documents now in a very heterogeneous context? Now, this closer linkage with international law is interesting because, in a way, you can argue that global bioethics and international law have the same themes and concerns. Even some of the principles that are rather similar, international solidarity, respecting life, economic justice, so you can identify a number of principles that are shared in both the legal and the ethical discourse now. There also is a focus on humankind as a whole. That, I think, are one of the characteristics of international law. You address humankind as a whole. You don't make distinctions, including future generations. And you go beyond certain boundaries that usually are assumed, or in the discourse of multiculturalism were also articulated, but now are criticized and overcome. And there are also new and interesting notions. And one of the interesting notions, specifically in the context of UNESCO, is the idea of a common heritage of humankind. You say, well, there are certain cultural products, there are certain accomplishments also in international law, where we identify what is common heritage of humankind. The outer space, the oceans, the air, cannot be appropriated by somebody. So there are certain commons that are not in the discourse of commercialization and business, but are belonging to humankind as such. And there is a tendency nowadays also to identify certain commons in the area of bioethics. One of the examples is in one of the declarations of UNESCO where the human genome is identified as common heritage of humankind. I can also say that maybe the declaration that I'm going to speak about soon of the UNESCO identifying biological principles is maybe in the same line of argument. They say we now have identified certain biological principles that are common heritage of humankind. Even if they have emerged and have been developed in a specific culture, they have now been accepted as part of the heritage of humankind itself. Maybe the issue of not only very abstract principles, but also very specific principle like consent can be regarded as such a principle. Now, if we talk about global bioethics, we need to be aware that there are two different levels where we can identify developments. One is the bioethical discourse as such, that we can see, well, we have conferences, publications, scales, so you can measure in a certain way the activity in bioethics by the events that are organized in a country or the legislation, the publications, the media attention that is there. But there is a kind of, so to speak, basic, more deep structure in bioethics where there are certain preconditions to be fulfilled before you can have the manifestations. And that is important because in a country like Germany or Holland, we already assume that this deep structure is there, but in many other countries it isn't. So there are certain immaterial conditions. You need to have recognition before you can do bioethics. In a country where bioethics is not recognized at all, it's very hard to do it. You need to have time, you need to have opportunity to do it. And you need to be independent. So in some cultural settings, this independency is not guaranteed. So there is no bioethical discourse because at the same time, it is not allowed because it is too risky and dangerous and critical of the authorities. And also material conditions that you need to have platforms, ethics committee, you need to have, if you want to do ethics teaching, you need to have a program in university, you have to have some kind of job to do the teaching. So these are all conditions that need to exist before you can have a bioethical discourse. So what we did in UNESCO to promote global bioethics is primarily focusing on creating the conditions for bioethical discourse. And that means that the focus was on teaching programs, how can we stimulate and encourage ethics teaching, how can we help countries to establish ethics committees, to create research facilities, to have public media where you can have discourse on bioethics in the population, and creating also national and international support. And here you see that the resources are very unequally distributed. UNESCO has built a database of ethics experts. And here you see that in Germany alone, you have more bioethics experts in the UNESCO database than in the whole of Africa and in the Arab states. So the majority of the experts is in Europe and North America. And that is, I think, maybe it's not complete, the database, but that reflects very well how expertise is allocated in different regions of the world. So if you want to have a more serious ethical debate in, for example, in African countries, you need to have more experts who are able to do that. So it means that you need either to create ethics teaching programs in African countries or help people to be educated in other countries, hoping that they go back to their own country. So this is also was one of the reasons why I think the major challenge nowadays in global bioethics is twofold. We need to focus on capacity building. How can we create an infrastructure in many countries, in an international perspective, on the long run, that allows people in the country to have a serious ethical debate? And not the way it is done now, that especially in the area of research ethics, where there is a lot of import of expertise into a country, hoping that they will improve the research protocols that have been devised by Western industries. And we need to have, secondly, a broader range of activities, because bioethics maybe here has a broad range of activities. But in many countries, you need, of course, to do teaching and consultation. But you also need to promote ethical debate, like we have it here in the country. You need to have influence on policy making, and I will also argue that maybe you need to have a little bit take the lesson from human rights activists and have more advocacy in the area of bioethics. So the need for capacity building, then the question was, how can you help countries to build an educational structure with a permanent structure, a basic structure that is owned by themselves? And there were two activities that are important that UNESCO tried to promote. That is, on the one hand, ethics education, on the building ethics committees. So that by these facilities, maybe you can have, in the long run, you can have some educational change. And we must not forget that in the Netherlands and Germany, it took 40 years to develop the infrastructure in bioethics. So you cannot expect that it will go much quicker in other countries. And there is a need for a broader set of activities, and that has to do with also the conception of bioethics that has developed, that bioethics is primarily regarded as an academic discipline, closely related to medicine and healthcare. Bioethics is more, if you look at all the activities that are undertaken today, more than an academic discipline. It is more than only reflection and analysis. And traditionally, it also used to be practical philosophy closely related to politics. And interpretation is, of course, necessary, but it is the first step towards action. And this is exactly also the set of ideas developed by Potter. Potter was arguing in his book in 1971 that all thinking is acting. We need continuously also in ethics to test and assess our ideas and see how they work, if they are practical or not. Bioethics also need to make a change. It's good to have a discourse, but if it does not result in any change, like it has in our own country, with the emphasis on patient rights and protection of research subjects, then why do we have the discourse? And bioethicists maybe should be more involved actors than spectators. They are not theoreticians. They should be more active in bringing about changes. And this was the background of the bioethics program also in UNESCO. UNESCO is the only organization in the UN system focusing on education, science and culture, established shortly after the war. And the main purpose, like all the emphasis at that time on human rights, was how can we prevent future wars? And how can we make sure that science, culture, education will contribute to peace and security? And this is in the Constitution of UNESCO. The first Director General was Julian Huxley, was a philosopher of biology, and he was the uncle of Aldous Huxley. And he had a clear vision of what the organization could do. And as a biologist, he wanted to apply the ideas of natural evolution on the evolution of cultures. So we can contribute, by cooperation among all nations, contribute to make science benefiting humanity in the longer run. And therefore, we also have to rethink morality in connection to science. UNESCO has, early on in the 70s, when there was more interest in genetics, development of reproductive technologies, reflected on the impact of life sciences on ethics. They have set up international conferences, ad hoc committees, but in the early 90s, they decided to establish a standing committee, International Bioethics Committee, that is independent, and it's the only committee of bioethicists on a global level. 36 experts, independent from the government, they can advise the Director General about the important issues in bioethics at the global level. And the organization also decided, the organization is a political organization, the members are governments, they decided that in 2002, ethics, and particularly bioethics, should be one of the five priorities of the organization, which is also a sign that for governments, this has become a major area of decision-making and policy-making. And they wanted to also the organization to be active, especially at the request of developing countries, because the developed countries, the US or Holland, they don't need UNESCO to do anything in bioethics because they have made their own regulations. And they have also the Council of Europe, their own guidelines. But most of the other countries, they don't have. They don't have any legislation and any guidance in this area. So in the first phase of the bioethics activities in UNESCO, that was 1993 to 2005, the emphasis was very much on standard setting. Can you develop international norms, international standards, that can protect people in all countries, like it is protecting people in some of the developed countries? For example, if there was concern about the Human Genome Project, that the outcomes of the project will be beneficial for only the countries that have done research in the context of the project, so that the benefits would not be equally distributed among all countries, while science should be for the benefit of humanity. But also there was a fear that maybe the risks of the project would be outsourced to Africa, so that they will not have the benefits, but only the damages and the cost and the risk. And therefore, they asked UNESCO to make sure that the same principles could guide the development of genetics. There was a search, in other words, for a universal agreement on some basic principles. That was a long process. And at the same time, UNESCO was also in an ambiguous position, because UNESCO is protecting the cultural diversity in all these different countries. That's why they have, for example, the heritage list of cultural products that need to be protected in different cultures. They have a program to protect languages that are on the verge of extinction. So they have to focus on diversity. At the same time, as is also said before the break, you can only have diversity if you have some common ground to agree and talk with each other. So there was the search for shared values and common goals. And there is no alternative, because if you want to reach agreement on some basic principles, the UN system is the only one that exists. Even if it's criticized, if it's imperfect, but there's no alternative except following the superpower. If you want really to share different views and different values, then you have the UN system. So that's why they tried to develop frameworks, and they did so with the Universal Declaration on the Human Genome, adopted in 1997. Then later, a more specific declaration on human genetic data. And then, because of the success with these two specific declarations, then the countries asked the Director General to develop a bioethics declaration in general, identify basic bioethical principles. How it was done was actually through two different ways. One way was to build on previous instruments. You could say in the UN system, you already have a lot of consensus in the declarations adopted by countries. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was also the basis for Europe as a region to develop its own instruments. For example, the Oviedo Convention on Biomedicine, which was then taken as an example, for example, by the French president, to argue that if they can reach agreement in Europe, we should try to reach agreement on the same bioethical issues in the whole world. And so that was a kind of existing agreement that was already there. Also within UNESCO itself, there was consensus in the area of genetics. And then the question was, can we broaden this consensus among our member states into the area of bioethics as a whole? If you look at the bioethics declaration and the text that has been adopted, you can say there are three ways how bioethics and human rights are related. Human rights are taken as a starting point, the context of the declaration, because it will be too challenging to say that human rights are now a foundation for bioethics declaration, but at least they are a starting point. Human rights itself are taken as a basic principle in the declaration, and human rights are working as a constraint for the application of the declaration. So I'll give you some examples of this relationship. Human rights as a starting point, because it's explicitly stated in the declaration that bioethical principles are anchored in human rights. It is emphasized in the preamble that ethical issues should be examined with a view to human rights and human dignity. They recall the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They make references to other human rights instruments, and they also refer to the OBM Convention, which is in exceptional because in UN declarations they often do not refer to regional statements. And it's one of the specific aims of the declaration also is to promote respect for human dignity and protect human rights. So this is the context in which the bioethics declaration has been developed. You can say, well, bioethics now is taken into this broader context of human rights. Human rights also function as a basic bioethical principle itself. In the declaration, the countries have adopted 15 different principles. And the first principle of bioethics that they have adopted is the principle of human dignity and human rights. And here you see the formulation, which is not very extensive, and it refers to human dignity, human rights, and fundamental freedoms. That is also in the charter of the UN and all the UN documents, so the countries could not really object to that. And the second thing is that they say that the welfare of the individual can never be subsumed under the interest of science and society, which is exactly the same phrasing as in the Nuremberg Code and the Helsinki Declaration. So that is also kind of application of the idea of human rights and human dignity here. Then third, human rights function also as a constraint, because you can only make an interpretation of the bioethical principles as long as it is consistent with international law. So you cannot use the bioethical principles to go against human rights. And that is specified for several specific principles. For example, principle of consent. You can only make exceptions to the principle of consent in accordance with international human rights law. The same for principles of privacy, principle of discrimination. They always have to be interpreted in the context of human rights. There are also new principles, principle of respect for cultural diversity, and that is at the same time the most limited one, because it's explicitly mentioned that you can never invoke this bioethical principle to go against human rights. Social responsibility is building on the right to enjoy the highest attainable standard of health. So in our specifications, in a sense, of what is already in the human rights literature. And then also there are two explicit articles in the declaration indicating the limits, that civil principles can only be limited by countries if they do it by law. But then for a specific reason, for example, public safety, and as long as the law is consistent with international human rights law. So, say, well, trying to reinforce the principles by stating that only under three summative conditions you can limit the application of the principles. So this is the link that has been made in this document, which is the only global document in the field of bioethics. And we see that there is a growing approximation in different ways and different discourses. And there are several reasons for that, due to the fact that bioethical discourse is now a global discourse, public discourse. It has claim to universality, like the human rights discourses. It has a link to policy, and that's the change from, let's say, from an academic discourse to a more policy-oriented discourse, because most of the developing countries, they want to make changes. They want to develop policies on the basis of this document. And it is also dissociated from a debate on the philosophical and theological foundations. And I think that's also a move that has allowed to progress in making a consensus. As long as you start to continue debating how principles can be justified, you will never reach consensus. So this consensus has been, let's say, won it to a certain price, that you now have maybe a bigger dissociation among the theoretical discourse of bioethics as is preferred by philosophers looking at the interpretation and justification, for example, of the principle of human dignity and the practical application of the principle in many discourses. And it has, it also, some people say, bioethics and the human rights discourse have the same origin. They're all emerging from the Holocaust as a reaction to the Holocaust and what happens there. They have the same goal, sharing the people, making sure that people can be used as means to another end. What is important, and I think there will be a lot of debate in the, it is already a lot of debate about this shift, that in fact in the early 70s when bioethics was emerging, there was a relation to human rights, but not very clear. And the bioethical debate in the early days of the bioethics movement was very much focused on the issue of cultural diversity and pluralism. At the same time, the human rights discourse was, let us say, in a lot of studies effective because it was bracketing the theoretical discourse on justification of human rights. What has happened nowadays is that there hardly is any discourse about justification of basic principles, human rights and bioethical principles. But there is more discourse about how it can be applied. And the issue of diversity is no longer in the bioethical discourse itself, but is more and more in the way the discourse is applied. You could say, well, now everybody has agreed that consent, for example, is a basic principle. And there was even a recent court case in the US saying it's a universal norm and it's a crime against humanity if we don't apply it in Nigeria or in other countries. So this is a norm that is now hardly, that is strongly determined, but the question still is, how can we apply consent in a culture that is illiterate, that has different notions of individuality, where the tribe is deciding and the community is important. So those are the issues of application and implementation that are nowadays more important. These principles in bioethics, so if you want to say, you can regard it as a change over the last 30 years from an academic discourse to more practical oriented activities, consultation, policy making, public debate, also a change from reflection to participation, and people want to engage, want to participate, and that's why also this issue of advocacy comes up. Maybe we should learn a lesson from human rights activism that were sometimes very important in identifying bioethical problems, especially in developing countries. This was the reason to establish the organization Bioethics Beyond Borders, to do essentially the same as human rights organizations, and to say, well, how can we implement human rights-based bioethics in developing countries? And how can we do that? By building a network of experts in different countries. Building a global network, expertise is very uniquely distributed. How can we bring together people with expertise in bioethics that have many examples of efficient strategies and connect them to people in developing countries where they need this expertise? So this is a list of activities. The first is maybe the most important one. How can we advocate? And that was a lesson also in UNESCO. Many people, policymakers, talk about bioethics and how important it is. If you look at practices, they are not applying it at all. And there is a need to a little bit put pressure on the system to make sure that the principles are applied and implemented. And that if the policymakers want to establish a national ethics committee in many countries, was the case in UNESCO, they never did it, that there still is some pressure on them to do it from different sides, from the medical profession, from the population, from citizens' organizations. So there is a need to put a little bit more pressure on the system to implement the principles that have been agreed on an international level. There can be many cases, questions in different countries, and I can give you many examples. And the idea is, how can we make sure that the experts in developing countries, for example, that are associated with the organization, can use the experts that have already many resources available to address the issue. And so that there will be the step forward in the application of bioethics beyond the theoretical discourse that it is often that often also is important. So this global network, I will show you here some of the data now, that there's several experts now available in countries where they have expertise, and another group of experts from countries where they need the expertise. So that the linking with the modern technology, you can easily do that, linking of these two groups of experts can make it possible for experts, for example in Ghana, to consult colleagues in Germany or in the US or the UK and help them solve and address certain issues in their own country. So this global network of experts is really taken seriously, that also in bioethics itself we should think in terms of a global community. We're not only at ASIST in Germany or in Holland, we belong to a global community where bioethics is important because itself is a global activity, and we need to support each other in the work we do. Thank you very much.